Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In July 1984, Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Joanna Connors was raped while out on assignment for her newspaper. Her attacker was quickly caught, convicted, and sentenced to a long prison term. But Connors' largely private struggle with the rape and its consequences went on. This month, nearly a quarter century later, Joanna Connors went public in a big way, telling the story of the rape and its aftermath in a 16-page special report in The Plain Dealer. One in six American women are the target of a rape or attempted rape. This hour on Point, Joanna Connors tells her story. Joining me now from Cleveland, Ohio, is Joanna Connors, staff writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. On May 4th, the paper published her story, a 16-page special report headlined Beyond Rape, A Survivor's Journey. It's gripping and raw, and you can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. Joanna Connors, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It's great. It's great to have you. And also with me, I should say, in the studio is Veronica Reed Ryback. She's a clinical instructor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, psychotherapist, private practice. From 84 that year to 2001, she was director of the Rape Crisis Intervention Program at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, one of the first hospital rape crisis centers in the country. Veronica Reed Ryback, thank you very much for being here and listening in with us, joining our conversation with Joanna.
Thank you for inviting me.
Joanna Connors, first to you. It's been a long, long time, the decision to write about this rape in this depth, at this length, and do all the reporting required to bring this story fully back to life must have been a big one. What brought you around to do this?
Well, an incident in 2005, actually, when I took my daughter to look at college campuses, and it was in the Boston area. Hmm. We were doing a tour of the campus, and I don't know if you mentioned, but my rape happened on the Case Western Reserve University campus. Mm-hmm. And we were touring campuses, and at one point the student guide said, and here is the blue light emergency station. And if you're in trouble or you're scared, all you have to do is pick up the phone here and call, and someone will be with you in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I had a panic attack, a true old-fashioned panic attack, sweating and shaking and feeling dizzy, which I, of course, tried to hide from my daughter. And I realized that this rape that I thought I had dealt with and buried, and I actually pretended it had never happened, was not gone, and I needed to deal with it.
Pretended to whom that it had never happened?
To myself. I stopped talking about it to my family. I had never told my children, who were not born at the time of the rape. I had never told many of my close friends. My husband and I stopped talking about it almost immediately. And I thought that the way to recover was to pretend it wasn't there.
We'll go back and be reminded, as you've reminded Cleveland readers, and at this point many more, but it's not as though it was off the screen. Your internal screen, I mean, you describe, so you had more therapists than you can count. You can't even remember
right.
all of them over the years, presumably much of that trying to deal with what you were also trying to forget.
Yes. Although it's funny, I always went in with a different complaint. It took me a long time in therapy, a couple of sessions anyway, which is a long time in therapy to me, to bring it up. I always went in with depression or... Well, mostly with depression, insomnia. Those were my presenting symptoms. And then it would come up. And, yeah, I did try to deal with it in therapy, but it was always just as, oh, and this happened too.
How did The Plain Dealer, your newspaper, your editor, deal with it when you, in effect, came to them and said, I want to write a very, very, very big story about what happened to me? When I was in the employ of this newspaper 24 years ago, this is I've never seen a rape in its aftermath described in this kind of searching, probing detail in any publication before. How did the Cleveland Plain Dealer respond to your interest in doing this?
Well, it is extraordinary, and it is all the work of our new editor, Susan Goldberg, who came to the Plain Dealer the summer of 2007 from the San Jose Mercury News. And I had started this search and journey on my own, intending to put it into a book, to make it into a book. And I had told my editor at the paper about it, asking him to write chapters as I wrote them. He had edited some longer narrative series I'd done before. And when the new editor came, she asked editors, well, what are your people doing? And he mentioned the book, and she called me in right away, rushed back to her office from a meeting with the mayor, which I thought was impressive, and said, I really want you to do this first for the paper.
A female editor may have had something to do with the fact that you found an open door. There's so much we want to learn here about what reader response has been to this and what you've learned about yourself and the world, and it's a lot in the process of bringing all this back to light. I wonder if you'd read a little bit for us from that day. This is back in 1984. You were covering theater for the Plain Dealer in Cleveland. As you said, you went out to Case Western Reserve University. You were running late for an interview you were supposed to do there in the theater. When you arrived, the place was, you thought at first, I think, abandoned, but then you saw, no, it was you plus one other. Could you read a bit for us?
Okay. I was late. I ran up the stairs to the small lobby area on the second floor and looked into the theater. Empty. Damn it, I said under my breath. They're gone. I didn't notice the guy standing on the other side of the lobby until he said, they said to wait a few minutes. They'll be back. He was leaning against the wall, smoking. He was a wiry guy, not much bigger than me, with an afro and big plastic glasses the size of bread plates, the style of the times. I fidgeted and smiled. A few minutes passed. He took another cigarette from a pack of Cools and lit it. After another couple of minutes, I gave up and was turning to go back down the stairs when he said, I'm working on the lights. Do you want to see what I've been doing? Okay, I guess so, I said. I'd never seen the guy before. A yellow light flashed briefly in my head. Caution. I ignored it the way I'd just ignored every yellow light on Euclid Avenue. I walked into the theater down the right aisle and climbed the steps to the stage. He was right behind me. He pointed up toward the lights with a vague wave of his hand and said something that made no sense. Animal alarm flashed through my body, followed by a flood of adrenaline that said, this is not right. In fact, this is bad, really bad. Get out of here now. I think I'll wait outside, I said. Too late. He grabbed me from behind, pinning my arms to my sides.
Joanna Connors, reading from very early on in her big 16-page special treatment in the Cleveland Plain Dealer of her rape 24 years ago in Cleveland. And Joanna, I should say, it's available. You can read it at our website or link to the full text of it. But you are not sparing in your description of what then happened in that empty theater, kind of at the back of the stage. Was it hell, or was it some kind of redemption to write that in such a way that you knew the whole community would read what went on in that all-too-private minutes years ago?
A little of both. I have to say that I, as a writer, and I think a lot of writers, sit there at our computers and we're alone, and we kind of, it's a very private thing. And looking into the future and imagining 450,000 people having it on their front page the next morning would be too daunting for me. But then as I came to the end, I was very scared of revealing this and very worried about what the response would be.
The response in the event appears to have been overwhelmingly positive. Women and men reaching out to you from all corners of the community and the country with support, with applause for telling this, with appreciation for you coming forward.
Yes, it was amazing. Everybody in the newsroom was flabbergasted, I'll tell you, because with email and voicemail, everybody who works in a public medium knows that you get a lot of nastiness, anonymous nastiness, and we got none, none. It was all supportive.
Veronica Reed Ryback, you've read this incredible tale of rape and recovery. Joanna Connors goes not only into her own story, but she makes the decision to learn about the rapist, his background, his family, what brought him to that moment. You've spoken with many rape victims over the years. What sets this treatment, this remembrance, apart to your mind?
Well, first I just want to say to Joanna that the courage that it took to take your journey and then to share it with the public is something that I have an enormous respect for. And I think one of the things that I've learned over the years from having seen or been involved with over thousands of victims, actually, is that everybody has their own journey to take. Mm-hmm. And many times it takes a very long time. I think we forget about that. And
24 years, not necessarily an eternity in terms of this kind of recovery.
No, and much of it has to do with the fact that people don't feel like they can talk about it, that there's so much shame and self-blame, and society, unfortunately, reinforces that, reinforces the silence and says, we don't want to hear about this. But the fact is that it happens and it takes a very long time, as Joanna has so articulately brought forward.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about surviving rape with Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Joanna Connors. She was raped 24 years ago, nearly, July 9th, 1984. Now, she's written about that trauma and her long road back in a special 16-page report for The Plain Dealer. She joins us from Cleveland, Ohio. Veronica Reed Ryback is with us as well. She spent years in Rape Crisis Center, one of the first in the country, established at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston. Joanna Connors took this up not just as an exercise of remembrance, but she does remember, but she also went back to that site of the rape, went into a recounting of its effect on her and her family, her manner of child rearing, her relationship with her husband. She went to the prison where the rapist ultimately went. She went to and found his family. She went to the site of the rape. She went to his grave site as he was dead by the time she came back. Joanne, I have to say, just in reading this, I found I just was, you know, there were moments when I was just choking up at the kind of visceral quality. I mean, there's the photographs here, I guess, from the legal files of your spine after this mm-hmm. rape, vertebrae rubbed raw against, I guess, the floor, the wall, I don't know. This, mm-hmm. You were unsparing in recounting what happened on that day, right down to the crucifix dangling in your face as this went on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I went back and looked and found the trial transcript. And I decided when I started this journey that I would do it as a reporter. And that would be one way that I could control the story. I think
with the
Veronica,
repertorial distance, a little bit of the,
right,
the professional
exactly.
stance there. Mm-hmm.
One of the repercussions of rape is that we feel that we've lost control of ourselves, of our bodies, of our stories in a way. And when I started thinking about how I would deal with this when it came up with my daughter, I thought, well, use the tools that you have. Be a reporter. You can take control back of this story and tell it and find out what happened. So I went back and got the trial transcript, and when I opened the envelope, out tumbled the cross and all kinds of evidence that just wham, brought me right back to everything.
This was a cross on a necklace that had dangled from his neck during this rape.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Ironic, isn't it?
Oh, well, ironic, but also, I mean, in the way that, you know, talk about something that would bring back the horror of an event. I can mm-hmm. scarcely think of something that would do it more quickly than that. And you yeah. went back to the site. Did you go? How did you do that? I don't think you'd been back in nearly a quarter century.
No, I had stopped being the theater critic. I had taken up other assignments, and I had deliberately not gone back. I knew it would be too tough. But I thought the end of the story would be going to see his grave. and confronting him there. But I felt empty when I went to see his grave. And then it wasn't my idea. My editor said, we need photos from the theater. And the photographer and I had been working together for several months. Mm. And she went with me. And it was there that I had that cathartic moment. And I realized that the theater was where he was and where he still was alive and where I was alive. And it was just a haunted place. And they lit it the way it was when the rape happened. There was just the ghost light on the stage. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I had an out-of-body experience much like the one I had during the rape. But then I was able to sort of come back.
To give us the context for understanding the next 24 years of your life after that terrible period, I wish you'd just give us a summary of what happened in the days immediately after the rape. This was in some ways unusual in that the perpetrator was very quickly caught, identified, taken to trial, convicted, and sent away for a long time. Can you give us, in a nutshell, what happened in the days and weeks following the rape?
Well, it turned out that he had been on parole just for a week after before he raped me. And who knows what crimes he did in that time that he wasn't caught for, because when I've looked up his record, it was just item after item after item. He was just seemed to be obsessed, have an obsessive compulsion to commit these crimes. But he returned to the scene of the crime. I always thought that was just in detective novels and movies.
He was back on the campus the next day and picked up by police there.
The very next day, wearing the same clothes. It was at the same time of day. And in 84, some changes had been made. I was not treated badly by the police at all. They tried their best. Some of them had been trained. Some of them hadn't. And the same with the prosecutor when it eventually came to him. He had not been trained, and he blundered in some ways, asking me questions that really suggested I had been stupid. I remember at one point he called me into his office and said, what the hell were you doing going into that theater? And I went home sobbing from that, because as Veronica said, we tend to blame ourselves, and I did blame myself for a long time and told myself I was stupid and why had I been so gullible and naive.
There was a strange quality to the encounter itself in addition to its horror, but there was you write that the rapist, and of course David Francis turned out to be his name, mm-hmm. Adopted a kind of weird intimacy with you, even at the end, as he walked away from you, you report his last words being to you, if I have to go to prison, I'll miss you, he said, almost cooing you, right? Then he kissed me on the lips and walked away.
Mm-hmm. Well, Veronica? I just jump in here to say that, again, that is one of the most confusing things for a victim survivor is the behavior many times of the perpetrator who's committing a very violent act, and yet they're pretending as if they're in a relationship with you. And this is not uncommon, but of course what it does to the survivor is that the messages are all mixed up.
Creates a sense of complicity where there is none.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so that also reinforces this sense of, you know, what did I do, or what did I do to make him feel that way about me, when in fact this is all their modus operandi that they do and they will do over and over again. The other point that you made that was, I think, very interesting and unfortunately true is that many perpetrators will keep returning to the same place. And from the studies that have been done, there is there's evidence that many times they want to be caught again.
Want
to be caught again because they are more at home in prison than they are in the outside world. that many times you'll find when they're just about to go off on parole that they will commit some kind of act that will get them put back in. So it's, I don't know what he was thinking, but I do know that this is not uncommon. Now, one of the things we tell people in a stranger rape situation is the chances are they're not going to come back, but they may.
To the site, in any case.
Yes, yeah.
Joanna Cunners, you write that there, even on that day, you had a flash of insight that there was a kind of prison rape quality to this. You soon had to pick him out of a lineup, which you did. You found yourself in court. You, as a reporter, were able to kind of go back and create this for a jury in a way that must have been quite persuasive because he was, it took them 1 hour to find him guilty on 18 counts. And the judge said to him that day, fortunately for her and unfortunately for you, speaking to the perpetrator, you picked on a woman who had the courage to fight back and stand up to you and prosecute you. And then he said, as you write, memorably, she prosecuted you, the jury convicted you, and for my part, sir, this is the judge speaking to your rapist, I shall bury you in the bowels of our worst prison for as long as I can, and sentenced David Francis to 30 to 75 years. This was, in some ways, a kind of definitive conclusion, but really no conclusion, you write, Joanna Cunners.
Yes, I love that judge. I've gone back and talked to him. And an interesting side point is that he stepped down from the bench a couple of months after that trial. The main reason was he had seven children and he had to put them through college, and judges don't make that much, at least not as much as lawyers do, and he went into private practice. Mm-hmm. But when I went back to talk to him, he said it was also that he just could not preside over another trial like that one, that it was just getting to be too much for him. He'd had two major rape trials in that year, and he just couldn't take it anymore. But his words did help me, and they helped me a lot, and I think in some ways that and the rapist being in prison enabled me to say, okay, this is over. I'm putting this away. I'm pretending it didn't happen. It's over.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to join the conversation. There's much more to this story, but let's begin to turn to them, if I may. Beth is calling from Lamoni, Iowa. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I've been appreciating the commentary this morning because that journey is similar to mine. Almost 30 years ago when I was in graduate school, a man broke in and raped me, and it is a long road back. Absolutely. And it's interesting to me the commonalities of the experience. I've talked to other survivors, and then hearing the people this morning, it strikes me that it's an interesting thing that, in spite of varying experiences, people's experience is very common.
Some constant factors here. How have you dealt with it over those 30 years, Beth? Have you been in therapy? Were you able to marry happily, have children? Did it affect the way you parented?
I'm very happily married, but that was not an easy thing to get past the sexual manifestation that the assault took. It was difficult for me, and still is sometimes, in certain kinesthetic ways.
To be intimate with your husband, to be reminded.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a sad thing, but there it is.
Mm-hmm.
And therapy, of course. And also, I took a turn at crisis hotlines throughout wherever I lived in the United States, counseling other people in a paraprofessional manner about their own issues. And when rape came up, it was a challenge for me, but I grew out of that experience as well.
Joanna, you must have had many women now approach you with stories like Beth saying, you're not alone, here's what happened to me. You must now be a real sounding board for these stories.
Yes, I've gotten emails and voicemails from all over the country and now from outside the country, too. It must be on websites that I'm not aware of. But what struck me is that in my newsroom, three women have come up to me and said, this happened to me and I have never told anyone. Which, these are professional reporters. Mm-hmm. These are people who tell stories. And it stunned me. It really stunned me. And I think the 1 in 6 statistic is way low.
It is.
Beth, thank you for your call. Yeah. Veronica, what about the numbers, the incidence of rape in this country?
Well, it's very hard to get the statistics, but yes, Joanna, the fact is that for the criminal justice system, which is only a small portion of people actually come forward to the criminal justice system, those figures they estimate are 10 times lower than the actual numbers that happen. Again, because of the silence that people keep.
Now, and we quoted a number saying 1 out of 6 women raped or attempted rape. Yeah. Most of them raped.
Right.
And you're saying that's 10 times too small? That's boggling my mind
a little bit. Well, the statistics, for instance, there was a study back in 1995 that where the numbers for criminal justice were 125,000. And, in fact, there were 650,000. They extrapolated from other kinds of statistics that they got from different kinds of reporting. So 1 in 6, 1 in 4, you'll hear. The fact is that we don't hear about it, and that's why, Joanna, your story is so important for people to know that they don't have to be silent. They have the choice of when to speak and to whom to speak. But the fact is that one needs to speak this and to get the kind of help that they need. You know, so many of your responses, and as the call-in person said too, those are normal reactions to the trauma of rape.
Let's hear from another listener, Kelly in Boston. Hi, Kelly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to commend Joanna on her courage, but also point out how, not fortunate, but how much society has changed so that rape survivors now can get help, so that they can get therapy, so they can get the support they need emotionally and psychiatrically and psychologically to move on. I survived a very brutal experience in my teens, which was in the 80s, and I have an aunt who went through a stranger rape in 1955. And the after effects for the two of us are so substantially different as a result of the advancements in therapy, of the ability for women like Joanna to talk about things. I mean, I've managed to go on to university. I have a career. I can't say my life is great because it's been horribly impacted by what happened. But my aunt, she prosecuted the guy. She put him in jail. Mm. And when he got out, there was no aftercare for her. She ended up having a severe breakdown and ended up dying homeless in the streets of New York.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
So it's absolutely astonishing to think of how fortunate we've been that women like Joanna have come forward and talked about these things over the years, and how fortunate we've been that society has started to really take notice of this and provide the care that they need to. So I just want to commend Joanna again for having the courage and talking about this and thank her for it.
Kelly, thank you for your call. And Joanna Connors, Kelly pointing there to the changing arc of how rape is understood, the freedom people feel to speak about it, institutions, organizations ready to help them with it. She's saying a huge advance between the 50s and the 80s, the same time that you were facing this challenge.
Yes. I think that's why my experience with the criminal justice system was not as bad, as people have reported from earlier times. And I say in the story that when I was in college in the mid-70s, rape became it was linked with the feminist movement and became a very big political issue. Mm-hmm. And it was talked about, but it was more talked about as an issue than as an experience. Mm-hmm. And my friends and I read Susan Brown Miller's book about rape, mm-hmm. and we all sort of saw it as something that we would march about, not something that might happen to us.
In the event it did sadly happen to you, Joanna Connors writes about the aftermath of that rape in great detail. We'll hear more of it when we come back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about surviving rape with Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Joanna Connors. July 9th, 1984, 24 years ago nearly, she was raped in Cleveland. Now she's written about that trauma and her long road back in a special big report that's getting lots of attention around the country and around the world. She went to find the family of the man who raped her, and we'll learn what she learned from that. But Joanna, I want to get a sense of how this lived within your life. You write, if I can just read a little from your series, and again, it's at our website, I'll link to it there, onpointradio.org, but you write, I might have buried this story, but it was not dead. It was still alive, and it grew in that deep place I put it, like a vine from some mutant seed, all twisted and ugly. And as it grew, it strangled a lot of other stuff in me that should have been growing. It killed my trust, my confidence. It almost killed my sense of who I was. I wish you could share some of that psychological journey on the other side of this rape that you experienced, Joanna.
Well, part of my denial, it really comes in layers, and part of my denial was not just about the rape, but that anything was wrong with me. And so I did a really good job of pretending that everything was fine. And I write in the story also that my friends would be surprised to know how often I sunk into depression, which was my way of reacting to it. Other people I've heard from have said anger or other emotional reactions that feel out of control and inappropriate. But mine was depression. I worked as the film critic for the paper for a number of years, which allowed me to work at home. And I wasn't a recluse by any means. I had two children. I did their school activities, but I really kept to myself a lot. And when I was depressed, since I worked at home, I was able to stay in bed and curl up in the fetal position. And that's always when I would say, I need to go see a therapist. Yeah. But I was also extremely overprotective of my children. And I've also heard this from rape survivors who have written to me. Every little scrape, I was ready to take them to the ER. Every sleepover was a potential kidnapping situation. And I am not exaggerating. I really, every sleepover, I just was tense the whole night. Do I know this family? Do I know the father? What's going on?
Right. And with your own, their father, with your own husband, there was a limit, you write, to how mutually supportive you could be. You say he tried to support you. He was consumed with rage. He wanted to kill the attacker. And then you write, he stopped talking about the rape. I stopped talking about it. Our silence clanged against the walls of our marriage. Wow.
Yeah, it really did. And I, like the caller, I also volunteered at the Rape Crisis Center and took the hotline training and found through that how very common that is, too. We went to a therapist right after the rape to get through the trial, to help us get through the trial. And one of the first things she said was, marriages don't often survive this. And she gave us a statistic that was daunting. But at the time, we just thought, no, that's not us. We'll be fine. And we didn't think that maybe she meant 10, 20 years down the line. And unfortunately, that's what happened with us. It was lots of factors, but that was a big part of it, that we shut down a big emotional piece of ourselves and didn't share it with each other.
You did talk about the rape with your mother, with your sister. Were they supportive over time, or did they also kind of cooperate in pushing it aside?
They did, and I do not blame anyone for not talking about it with me or bringing it up, because they followed my lead, and they got the clear message from me, I'm fine, don't talk about it, I'm fine. And so everybody said, okay, she doesn't want to talk about it, let's not talk about it. So I don't think that it's anything that they decided. I think they were picking up that message from me.
And what about your children? When they finally learned all those years later with your work on this big telling of the story, how did they respond?
Well, my daughter, they were both shocked at first. The way I told my son was I showed him the story in the paper about the sentencing. The paper, of course, covered the not the trial, but when the rapist was sentenced, they wrote a story. And I had kept it, and I showed it to him, and he was confused. And he said, why are you showing me this? And I said, I was the victim. And he was just silent and shocked. He was 19 at the time. And he is very much like me, oddly enough. And he keeps a lot to himself, But
he went out and got a big tattoo on his chest, a heart that said "Mom" in the middle of it, and I could feel the sort of a demonstration of loyalty in that. He was looking for some way. What about your daughter?
Yeah. She became a lot more like I was in the 70s, which I was so happy to see. I want my kids to lead bold lives and to not be fearful. And she said, well, this explains a lot about all that fear and all that protectiveness over the years from you and Dad. And she talks about it more. She wasn't angry, but she talks about when she went to college, she's told me a couple of times, you know, the girls here don't think this will happen to them, and they take a lot of risks, and I keep telling them it could happen to them, and they just are not listening to me. So she has not volunteered at a rape crisis center yet, but I see that on the horizon for her, not in my encouragement, but just the way she's talking to her friends.
Joanne, we have so many people who want to speak with you. Let me go to Lake Linden, Michigan, and Lynn. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air with Joanna Connors.
Thank you. This is so important that you're talking about this. I was raped by my professor. My goodness, I didn't think I was going to be emotional. Mm. I was raped by a professor when I was a PhD candidate in 1974. And it's defined my life ever since. And I bet he doesn't remember. But so people have asked me in my life, why didn't you finish your PhD? Mm. And only recently have I told them that they don't want to hear that. And they're shocked. Mm-hmm. And only recently have friends I have known for 20 and 30 and 40 years told me about their rapes. Often, one woman I have known for 30 years told me that she was raped when a doctor was examining her. Mm-hmm. And she hadn't told anyone before she told me.
Lynn, what does it mean to you to hear Joanna speaking so forthrightly about it, you know, on the air, in print?
It is. I think that it is that the way that you're talking about, Joanne, is the beginning of a new kind of discussion. It's not about rights. It's not about assertiveness. It's about common suffering. I became a journalist so that I could hide it bad with my depression. Mm. And I told my daughter when she was 15, and she said I was not married to her father then, but that I didn't tell my husband that I had been raped. It affected the marriage. It hung over the marriage. When I told my daughter when she was 15, she said, somehow I always knew.
Somehow I always knew. Mm-hmm. Lynn, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Let me get one more, if I may, from here from Karen in Avon, Connecticut. Karen, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I can understand how difficult that was for the last caller.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only agree with all the other callers about how important this subject is and how important this is for Joanna to have done this article and to have this on the air. I also had a rape experience, and this was back in 1970, shortly before I was to be married. And one of the things that Joanna had said is how she had blamed herself in some ways, because you do that, and I did too, because I went off to a party with, you know, some people that I didn't know, and had like a half a drink, which, I know and believe now was drugged in some way, mm-hmm. and I was laid down on a mattress, and I was in and out of not even knowing what was going on, and it was more like a gang rape with multiple guys coming in and out of the room and then just dropped off at my house in the morning. And it was just such a horrifying experience.
And the effect on your life over the decades, Karen?
The effect on my life was just horrific, because at the time, rape was not spoken about. You didn't hear about it. And it was only in then, beginning in the 70s, that I heard the first, you know, rape case actually being, you know, coming out in public. And it made me think, oh, I should do something about this. But I didn't really know these people. I knew one was the brother of a doctor that I had been working for, which was how I got to this party. And then I thought, oh, well, you know, what am I going to do about this? I live on the other side of the country now. And I just kind of just put it all aside, and I stuffed it for all those years until about 8 years ago.
And finally,
I had depression all those years, mm-hmm. in and out of depression, you know, just struggled with this, you know, sexuality with my husband, you right. know, just all the things that have been talked about today. And just kept this to myself, terrible nightmares, but just went on with my life as though nothing had happened. I just pushed it away.
Karen, let me bring that to Joanna and Veronica, but thank you for sharing that with us as well. Veronica, we heard Lynn say earlier she's hopeful of a new kind of conversation emerging around this, a new freedom to be forthright, to bring it forward. Clearly holding it in the dark is excruciatingly painful for victims. Do you see a new kind of conversation being able to come forward, or is there some timeless block against it?
Well, I would hope that there is, and I think that each step that we take in that direction needs to be honored, and hopefully this will continue to be. But certainly since I've been in the field, which is the very same year that the rape happened to you, which was 1984, I've seen it ebb and flow in terms of what people will be willing to talk about and how they're willing to see things. And I think, Joanna, you're saying that you learned about this through Susan Baumiller's book, and it was an intellectual and political debate, never thinking that it was going to be an experience that you were going to have yourself, is another way of having not a real dialogue. I'm saying it's, you know, you can, however you can push it away, however you can get some distance on it. And that's what people want to do. They don't want to face the reality of that kind of brutality happening to people. So I think it's important for also having shows like this where people can begin to have the conversation in public.
Joanna, you pushed through the personal experience, which you describe in detail, but you also wanted to understand the kind of public terms of this. You pursued your attacker. He had died in prison already, it turned out, but you tracked down his family, not for revenge at this point, but to try and understand. You say that he had come on that day in 1984 from a world you didn't know. You write, when he raped me, the two Americas, the two Clevelands, collided. One was white, suburban, well-off. The other was black, urban, and desperately poor. You found out about really the tragic story of his own youth that led him in its own way to that stage on that day.
Mm-hmm. A real cycle of violence and abuse. I found his sisters through digging through all kinds of old files. It took me a while. I found a sister in Massachusetts, which is where he had grown up, and went to see her. And it was an extraordinary experience. The first day I went, I just told her I was writing about him because he had died in prison. I was afraid to tell her why I was there and who I was. I of course, told her my name and that I was a reporter. And then I arranged to see her the second day, and I told her I was his victim, and she was shocked. She said, "I, that isn't the brother I knew." But all eight of the children in the family had descended into some kind of criminal life, if you can consider drug abuse criminal. They had been prosecuted for it anyway.
The brothers had been beaten by their father, who had treated the women miserably in his family.
Yes, he was a pimp, actually, and he had two of his women living with the family and their children. And Charlene, the sister I found first, talked about how she didn't realize that wasn't a normal family life until somebody in school told her, "Your daddy's a pimp."
It struck me that, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Well, towards the end of our conversation, she said, "I know what you went through because I've been raped too." And that was just a moment where I thought, whoa, I have very little in common on one level, but I have a lot in common on another level with this woman sitting across from me.
With this whole exploration, and our time is so short, but what emerged as most important to you, Joanne? This was, in a way, a kind of a political exploration, to look at the sociological facts of your rapist's upbringing, but there was a personal exploration at the same time. Mm-hmm. Which ultimately, finally, to you was more important, or do you even look at it that way?
The whole journey altogether, was what happened, what worked for me. And if I could just read one, my conclusion, I think this explains exactly how I feel.
We've got 50 seconds. Yes.
Yeah. As I worked on writing this, I kept saying, I'm having a hard time with this. I can't write it. Not long ago, my therapist said, maybe you're saying I can't write it, R-I-G-H-T it. Maybe. And maybe that is the point in the end. We all have burdens we must carry through life, grief and disappointments that we cannot change. But we can make them lighter if we do not bear them silently and alone.
Well, I want to compliment you. You've done so much in opening this up. I've never seen a telling in this depth, in this honesty before, and with the skill of a reporter put behind it to boot. It really is a kind of breakthrough piece of journalism, Joanna Connors, and we're very grateful to you for doing the hard personal and public work to produce it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Joanna Connors' big story in the Cleveland Plain Dealer is headlined Beyond Rape, A Survivor's Journey. And Veronica Reed Ryback, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate your insight and experience on this front. Thanks a lot for being here.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can read the whole story at our website, onpointradio.org, and download the podcast there as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.